Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us, like we like to say. As soon as I can get that word out of my mouth.
I'm Amy Scott. And I'm Amy Scott, in for Kimberly Adams. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It's May 16th, and it's time that we dive deep into a single topic. Today, that topic is streaming, the economics of the streaming industry.
So, with an eye on the writer's strike and what that has meant and where it has all come from, we're going to talk about how streaming has changed the way your favorite shows get made, how writers get paid or perhaps don't, and what it all means for the future of this industry of which we all partake to some degree or another, especially everything that's given that's happening with AI. That's a huge part of the strike. Here to make us smart is Kate Fortmuller. She's a professor of entertainment and media studies at the University of Georgia. She is also the author of the book Below the Stars, How the Labor of Working Actors and Extras Shapes Media Production. Kate, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so look, let me start you off with a biggie. Given the writer's strike and what we've all been hearing about AI and mini rooms and how what we have now on streaming are shorter seasons with longer episodes, but no more of this, you know, 22 episodes of 22 minutes apiece with ad breaks, all that jazz. Has streaming broken television?
Oh, that's a very provocative way to put it.
You know.
Well, I think it depends on the perspective that you are taking. I think for audiences, many of us would say that it's made television better. But for writers, I think has it broken television is maybe a fair assessment.
What about for studios? Sorry, let me just climb in here and ask the third part of that trifecta there, right? Audiences, writers, and now the studios.
Well, I think, again, that depends on the perspective that you're taking. I think if we're thinking about studios and networks that operate on these kind of older models, right? Television used to operate on an ad-based model and then moved to a subscription model, and then Netflix has moved to a minutes watched model. I think for the legacy networks, they're still trying to really figure out how to make this as profitable as the broadcast mass audience ad-based model. So I guess I would say the answer to that is kind of complicated. I think everyone sees a lot of potential. The question is whether or not it can sort of live up to that potential.
So Kate, from a viewer standpoint, a subscriber standpoint, it seems like there is so much out there to watch. I mean, this has been called the golden age of television or peak TV. It would seem like there are plenty of opportunities for writers. So why do they say they're having trouble making a living doing this?
Well, we are in a moment of peak TV. The number of shows have been continually going up since 2009. So there are lots of shows. But lots of shows doesn't necessarily translate into a full year of work for individuals, right? So somebody might get a job for a show that is sort of a short season and then might be under contract with that show, even if they're not getting paid for a certain period that is extended from that, or they might not have the kind of experience to then get them on another show, so they might have longer breaks. So really what a lot of these writers are experiencing are shorter periods of employment.
I wonder if we ought not point out here that while times have changed for the big streamers, Netflix, of course, and Disney and all the rest of them, they're still making boatloads of cash.
They are making boatloads of they are always making boatloads of cash, right? And part of what they are always trying to do is kind of increase those margins, right? I think the other thing that we kind of haven't brought up is when we're talking about these models, one of the really big changes is that streaming operates on a global model. So they are really looking at this as a global business and thinking about their global subscriber numbers. And that really does change the kind of picture when we're thinking about how are writers then getting paid for, you know, subscriber growth in Spain. The answer is they're really not, right?
Kai mentioned this up top, but can you talk about the mini room? This is getting a lot of play in the conversations about this strike. What is the mini room and what do writers say is wrong with it?
Yeah, so the mini room, and I think there's the WGA has kind of has released what they asked for when negotiations were happening in May, what they asked for, and then what the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers countered with. So mini rooms, if you look at that chart, are also termed like pre-greenlight rooms. So essentially what these streaming services are doing are bringing in writers to map out the entire season before the show has been greenlit. So they're getting a lot of writing work from them that's not tied into kind of episodic stuff that will come later. So what they're doing is sort of like hiring a team to do something else and then not necessarily bringing as many people on later. So this is really kind of upending the structure of the room and the number of people who are getting paid on any given season.
Just continuing with that thought, how valid do you think the position by the Writers Guild is that what's at stake here really is writing as a profession, as an absolute profession you can make money out of?
I think that's very much like an accurate statement. Huh. I think that this is I think that there's a lot of things that have kind of shifted in terms of, I think one of the things we can kind of think about is the rise of this term showrunner, right? Mm-hmm, I think if you think back, right, there were just so few kind of names that you knew associated with programs that you loved, right? But this idea of the showrunner as kind of an author is also something that's kind of moving people away from thinking about television as a collaborative medium, which it very much is, right? I think there are many shows, writers' rooms organize their credit in different ways in terms of who gets credit for an individual episode. Some episodes of television are really written in a collaborative fashion. So the number of people that are in the room are often really essential to that creative process. This is also, I mean, you know, it's not physical labor, but this is labor that makes a lot of money for a lot of people. And it is an art form. It is something that you hone over time. People get trained in these rooms. They learn a lot by being in the room with experienced writers, and shifting all of this is making this much more casual, right? That people aren't necessarily getting trained up in the same way. So if we want great television, which we have been enjoying, right? We've been enjoying many, many seasons of great television. But if we really want that to continue, we really need to think about the structure of these rooms and support writers as they try to get fairly compensated.
So can we address the elephant in the living room, which is the rise of AI and generative chatbots? I understand this may be the first industry to really get some protections written into their contract if they're successful. The Writers Guild says, you know, they want AI to not write or rewrite anything, be used as source material. And I thought this was really interesting. Also, that their content can't be used to train AI, which is interesting. How successful do you think they might be?
I mean, I was going to say, as a scholars, we don't always like to predict. That puts us in
you.
A really, it does put us in a kind of scary position. I guess what in terms of how successful, I don't know if this is going to progress if there isn't some sort of conversation opened up about AI. I don't know that, as is the case with any negotiation, are they going to be able to get the AMPTP to agree to all of the things that they want to kind of be in the contract? Probably not. But this isn't going to happen next year. AI is not ready to start writing our television shows in 2024. But the writers have to get this into their contracts so that they have a seat at the table when the technology improves, when this becomes a serious issue in 5, 10, 15, however much time it takes. This needs to be in their contracts so they have a place to start bargaining from. So this is part of, you know, their particular contract. So I think it needs to be there. I think they're very clear that it needs to be there. There's been a lot of referencing to the 2007-08 strike, where the writers said that, you know, the studios were saying, oh, we don't know how profitable the internet is going to be, right? Fast forward to 2023, we know that streaming is quite profitable. So they need to be ahead of the game. They need to get something in now, even if it's not necessarily going to be as expansive as they probably want it to be.
So let me just go back to where I started as sort of a way to bookend this thing. So not, did streaming break television, but do you suppose there's a recognition that we're never going back, that streaming is now the way it is, and the business model has changed?
Well, Netflix introduced an ad-supported tier this year. So, it's hard for me to say that the business model has totally
Yeah,
changed.
fair.
What we're seeing a return to some of those legacy models. I think one of the things that I don't think is going to change is the kind of reliance on these shortened seasons. I think those are kind of here to stay. And ultimately, miniseries have always been kind of a model that television has used, but on streaming, I think for the consumer, we have a lot of television to watch. And I don't know about you, but sometimes when I'm deciding, do I want to start this show that I haven't seen that's 4 seasons versus this one that's 6 episodes, I'm oftentimes inclined for the kind of more instant gratification, finish the show, feel like I'm kind of caught up. So I think there's some appeal, at least for audiences, to keep having those shows, and they allow streamers to continue to drop something constantly, right? Every week, something new. So I think that is here to stay. But those old models, the ad model was quite profitable. So I think people always look back when they're trying to problem solve. It's hard to really shake some of things that were making money for many decades.
Right, so look, are y'all caught up on Succession? Because that's a quick 4 seasons. It goes really
No
fast.
spoilers, Kai. No
No,
spoilers.
no spoilers. Goes
Oh,
pretty fast, though.
that is the show that in my house we
All right.
obsessively wait for on Sundays. So
Same
yes.
here. Same here. Kate Fortmuller is a professor of entertainment and media studies at the University of Georgia down in Athens. She's also the author of the book Below the Stars: How the Labor of Working Actors and Extras Shapes Media Production. Kate, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time and your expertise.
Thank you
Yeah,
for having
thank you,
me.
Kate.
Thank you.
Man, I'm still on season 1,
Are
so we
you?
can't even talk
Amy
about
Scott, just take a
That's
weekend. You could
fine.
be
I
all
mean,
caught up.
I want to support the writers here, but I'm like, I have such a backlog of TV. This I'm not going to notice the strike for some years.
Oh, man. If you happen to be, by the way, a writer on strike, or if you've been impacted, or you've got thoughts about the direction the streaming industry is headed, let us know. We want to hear from you. Our number is 508-827-6278, 508-UBSMART. Or you can email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. We are coming right back. All right, on the topic we were just talking about, Amy Scott has some news. You go first.
Yeah, just a little more follow-up on the writer's strike. I read a piece by Megan McArdle in the Washington Post today about the potential lasting impact, and she pointed out that during the last strike, which lasted 100 days in 2007 and 2008, the cost to writers and other workers from missed work was estimated to be $772 million. More than $2 billion in damage to the broader California economy. Of course, there were long-term gains for writers, like the union got jurisdiction over what was back then called new media,
Remember that?
AKA writing for the internet. But one thing, I haven't been following this closely, but you may have seen others say that one thing that the strike gave rise to, of course, was reality TV got a big boost because it's unscripted, which gave a big boost to the Apprentice franchise at a time when it wasn't doing so well. And Megan and others say kind of, it was part of what boosted Donald Trump's profile and paved the way for his successful presidential run. So don't blame the writers. Some people push back on how big a deal that was, but kind of interesting side note or footnote to this story.
Yeah, I totally buy it that was the big deal, by the way. Without that, the history of this country would be completely different. Okay, mine is a little more nuts and bolts, and it's an earnings report today from Home Depot, which I stole out from under Amy Scott, so I apologize for that, Amy, but, you know, I was up early. What can I tell you? Home Depot
early
said
today. Early bird gets the worm.
That's right. Home Depot, of course, the big, you know, home supply and goods store, said today annual sales are going to decline this year for the first time in more than a decade as consumer spending tightens and demand for home renovation projects continues to soften. For those of you who are in the not a soft landing, but there is actually going to be a not small economic slowdown, this is one indicator in your favor. And Amy threw a really helpful graph, actually, in the rundown from the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard. Home remodeling market projected to contract, that is to say shrink, not just slow down, but actually shrink by 2024 by like a lot, by like 3% over the prior year. So I actually still wonder how we can have a recession when unemployment's at 3.4%. But this is a sign that maybe it's coming anyway. I don't know.
Yeah. And just one note about this is, of course, a lot of home improvement takes place when homes are bought and sold, because mm-hmm. you're mm-hmm. either fixing it up to sell or you're fixing it up after you buy a fixer upper. And there's just not a lot of buying and selling mm-hmm. of houses going on because of those higher interest rates. So this is kind of the predictable end to what had been like a decade-long boom in home improvement spending. Though with more of us staying in our houses because mm-hmm. we can't move anywhere, or, you know, we don't want to give up our low mortgage rates for 6%+, there is going to be still, I think, some demand for fixing up the old house rather than moving.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, that's it for the news fix. Let's do the mailbag.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
All right, we were talking last week, Kimberly and Drew and I, during Half Full, Half Empty, about Wendy's using AI to take drive-through orders, and we got this.
This is Andrew in Houston. I called a pizza chain last month to place an order and was absolutely floored when the traditional robot menu transitioned into a seamless conversation with what was clearly an AI interface.
Wow.
However, not only did it not have glitches or speech delays, but it understood the nuance of my requests. When I asked for garlic on my pizza, it asked if I wanted crushed or minced. The overall experience was so shocking, I couldn't help but talk with the employees when I got there. Turns out it's a third-party contractor that's being run on top of their in-house systems. It will definitely be interesting to see what other applications may come about from this revolution. But I, for one, welcome our robot overlords. That last part was in case they're monitoring us already.
They probably are. Thank you, Andrew. Yeah, I don't know. That's a little freaky. I'm just going to say that. It's a little freaky.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
That's scary. Have not had that experience
yet. No, me neither.
All right, before we go, we're going to leave you with this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which, as you know, is what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about?
Hey, guys. This is Melissa from San Francisco. I have two young children, ages 5 and 2. And one thing I realized that I was totally wrong about was I would go visit my friends and family that had young kids before I did and would always sit there and go, God, how did you let your house get so messy? And now I don't know how they even kept it as clean as they did.
Yeah.
It's 9:30 at night and I'm just starting to do dishes and have so much to do. Keeping your house clean when you have two young children is magic. And anybody that can do it should be considered a magician. Thank you guys for keeping me company while I do dishes.
Totally agree. There can be no shame when there are little kids in the house. Forget it, man. All bets are off. Truly.
What about when the kids are older? I'm still working on that one.
Well, you can tell them to pick up and clean up, right? I mean, that's the deal.
You can try.
Yes, you can try. Yes, you can try. That is true. That is true.
All right. We want to know what you've been wrong about. You can leave us a voice message with your answer to the Make Me Smart question. Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UB-SMART.
Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Our intern is Antonia Barreras. Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Becca Weinman's going to mix it down later.
Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer is Marissa Cabrera. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcasts. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital. And Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough.
There it is. That's the show.